I think we've all heard the saying, time kills deals, and it's true. And the quicker you can get a deal papered and then to the finish line, the better for everyone.
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here are your hosts, Jamie Farley and Paul Keckney, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Welcome to Driving Performance. I'm Jamie Farley, here with my co-host, Paul Keckney. And today we're diving into one of the most critical aspects of any buy-sell deal, the legal side. To help us navigate this, we're joined by Monica Hohenschel, a buy-sell attorney from Calvert Law Firm, who has helped countless dealers get their deals across the finish line.
I've had the pleasure of working with Monica on a number of transactions over the years. She is certainly the expert in knowing how to keep a transaction moving and also kind of avoid some of the issues that create really slowing a transaction down, all while protecting her client. Monica, by the way, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul, and I appreciate the kind words. Certainly what I strive for as deal counsel is just what you said, to get the deal done while protecting my client, but also getting the deal done efficiently and getting it across the finish line, which is everyone's goal in a transaction.
Well, there's attorneys that kind of want to die on a hill to protect their client, and we all understand that, but there's also, you got to get the transaction completed or it doesn't work for anyone, and you've certainly got the ability to make that happen. So we certainly appreciate you being on the show and being with us today.
I appreciate you having me.
Yes, Monica, welcome, and I can't wait to get into more of that great information and your insights today. Why don't we first just back up a little and tell us a little bit about your background and overview of your experience?
Sure. Born and raised and lived pretty much my entire life in Oklahoma. Went to undergrad at Oklahoma State University, followed by law school at the University of Oklahoma, and then got an LLM, which is a master's in tax law at NYU. The year after law school, and came back to Calvert Law Firm in 2004, where I've been practicing ever since. And I would say during that 20 plus years have probably handled on average 10-ish dealership buy-sells a year. And so feel pretty comfortable in talking about those and advising on those. We've been on the buy side, the sell side. You know, we've done small deals, great big deals with multiple dealerships involved, with real estate, leasing and purchasing and seller carry financing, you name it. We've probably mostly done it. And so I feel like that puts us in a good position to step in and help most dealers through the process, because we've gotten pretty familiar intimately with the business side of the dealership business, as well as the transactional and the law part.
In your experience, what is maybe the biggest misconception a dealer or a buyer, maybe even a seller, has regarding the legal process and how it all works?
I think the thing that jumps out at me the most that I've seen, and this generally will happen with someone who's bought or sold a deal and then is on their second or third one, and they think, oh, it's a one-size-fits-all thing, and what we did last time will work this time, and they just take the contract from their first buy-sell and replace some names and dates and numbers and send it along, and that doesn't really serve them very well generally, because every deal, you know, even if you're on the sell side both times, every deal has its own nuances and things, and the world of buy-sell sort of shifts and changes, and there are just specific things that need to be addressed in each deal that, you know, if you've only done one and you're not an attorney, you wouldn't necessarily know to be addressing.
Yeah, good advice. So no cookie cutter approach to asset purchase agreements then?
Correct. There just isn't one. I mean, certainly there is a starting point, but that needs to be tailored to each transaction and the specifics of those transactions and the business and the deal.
Absolutely. Great advice. Can you tell us your thoughts on the first stage of the buy-sell process, which typically is the letter of intent? We know this is a non-binding agreement. So how much does it matter if an attorney's involved at this stage?
Yeah, you're right. Generally, the LOI is non-binding. And so a lot of times clients will come to us after they've got a signed LOI and get us involved. The thing that I see with that is there are certain things that they haven't thought of or they've missed that are actually in the letter of intent, but not the way we would like them to be. And so when we go to draft an agreement, while it's not binding, what's in the letter of intent, it's difficult to back up on what you've agreed to there. And the more you do it, obviously, the worse it is for your relationship with the other party. And so you want to try to stick to those terms. And so I would say maybe my advice would be you don't need an attorney involved really early, but before you actually sign a letter of intent and before you've really negotiated much of it, maybe just have an attorney that knows what they're looking for and knows what they're doing. Take a quick look at it just to make sure there isn't anything that's going to be a problem when you go to actually start negotiating the definitive agreement.
I would add on to that, by the way, Monica, you stated an attorney that knows what they're doing in this space, and it's so true. We tell our clients, both buyers and sellers, hey, you may have a great attorney, but try and find one if they don't specialize in M&A and the auto industry. Find one that does. It makes such a difference. Going from that, where do you like to start as far as the asset purchase agreement? We in our past as brokers have usually said we want the buyer to produce the first draft of an asset purchase agreement in a real estate contract or a lease, only because we believe it kind of gets them engaged in the process. But what's your preference? And maybe we're wrong there. I'd be curious on your take.
Well, my preference is always that I get to start with my draft because I'm more used to my agreement and it's more efficient for my client and me, and it's just easier.
Yes.
But you're right. The industry standard is generally the buyer gets to take control if they want to. That being said, oftentimes if we're on a deal and I'm representing the seller and the buyer's counsel isn't real active in this space, and we will often suggest, hey, let us take the first shot at this because we feel like we do have pretty good starting forms and we can do it relatively efficiently and get the ball moving more quickly than if we're waiting on someone who doesn't necessarily have the forms to start from and know what they're doing with them as well.
Right.
Taking a deeper look at the asset purchase agreement, is there a certain section or a clause in the APA that dealers you see that they're overlooking and then maybe later regret? And can you share maybe a specific example?
The thing that really comes to mind there the most would be kind of your post-closing access to information and rights to use information. The thing that comes to mind for me is I had a deal several years ago where there wasn't any language in the agreement saying that the seller couldn't kind of use the information from the dealership they were selling. So customer information and things like that moving forward to contact those customers or those kinds of things. And they did start doing that. And of course, the other side was not happy about that because they feel like this is really what I paid for. And while there may be some legal protection there just by virtue of state law, I think it's cleaner and better to have it very clearly spelled out in the contract what the expectations are as far as the business records at the dealership that's being sold.
So how did they end up resolving that? And did the both attorneys have to get involved at that point to try to figure things out?
Yeah, so I think ultimately there was a demand letter, like a cease and desist letter sent. Frankly, I'm not sure if it got resolved very well. So again, I think that it wasn't something that the buyer was willing to push enough to go litigate and spend a lot of money and time chasing it, but it's certainly something they would have preferred not be happening and be able to stop a little more easily. And that's why I say if you spell it out in the purchase agreement and then you've got a breach of contract claim plus whatever state law legal remedies are available, it's a little more clear and there's a little more bite behind that cease and desist letter rather than, well, just go see what you can do to me in court. And if you want to go spend all that time and money chasing, you know, chasing it down.
It comes back to, for a buyer and seller, have an attorney that understands and knows mergers and acquisitions in the automotive dealer space, right?
Right. Yes.
So what are you seeing from a manufacturer? You know, once we do the asset purchase agreement, we do the real estate contract, it really goes off to the OEM. And at that point, it's in the hands of the buyer and the OEM. What do you see that buyers tend to do that would not leave a good relationship with the OEM as they're going through that process? Is there anything that stands out for you that a buyer should be aware of or not do in the future?
Well, yes. I think one, I had a recent transaction where the buyer was not incredibly forthcoming with the manufacturer about their structure and ownership, and they weren't being very transparent. When pushed on it, you know, I think the buyer principles got pretty defensive with the manufacturer, and that did not go well. And so I would say, one, to the extent that you can, you should be as forthcoming and upfront and volunteer whatever information you can to the manufacturer that they want and need about your structure and your setup, and do it as clearly and quickly as possible and be as responsive as you can be. And certainly don't get caught up on this principle of, I shouldn't have to just because I don't want to. That doesn't really serve anybody very well.
Well, in my experience, a couple of things that I've heard from the OEM side, it's like, hey, we'll work at the same pace that the buyer is working. So if the buyer goes slow, the manufacturer says, well, we'll go slow. And then they start to really distrust the whole future relationship with that potential dealer if they're not moving in a timely fashion.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why I say yes. I mean, as quickly and as clearly as you can get them the information they need, the better, because the buyer, the seller, both of them are going to start at some point pushing the manufacturer to say, you need to get this done quicker for us. Well, if you haven't been moving quickly and then you turn around and start pushing them to move quicker, that will leave a bad taste in their mouth. No doubt it would anyone's.
That's definitely valid. Have been on the OEM side for 25 years before doing this. I could definitely say that those are all true statements.
Yes.
So speaking of OEMs, let's talk about right of first refusal. What have you been seeing lately, and how do you advise your clients on this topic?
I would say in the past year to 2 years, several of the OEMs have been pretty active in exercising their rights of first refusal. And so it's something we try to address upfront, if at all possible, and at least talk to our client about, is this a concern for you? And it obviously is a bigger concern when you're on the buyer side than the seller side generally. But, you know, if it is a concern, we look for ways to try to dissuade or make it more difficult for the manufacturer to exercise their right of first refusal. If you've got some special something about your buyer that they're bringing to the table that maybe a manufacturer's assignee wouldn't be able to fulfill, you can do some things like that. If they can make some promises about some things they're going to do after the closing that, again, would be difficult for another buyer to do, that can be helpful. Obviously, if you've got more than one franchise involved in a deal and they're all tied together, that can make it more difficult. Sometimes you might, if you've got real estate involved, which you always do, but if you've got some opportunities to kind of make the real estate transaction maybe not as attractive to another buyer, or again, just some way kind of tailor it to your specific buyer in a way that another buyer may not be able to follow through on the exact terms or wouldn't want to. Those are some things that we would look for to do to try to dissuade the ROFR from being exercised.
So thank you for that. Moving on, what is the shortest transaction you've seen start to finish, and what is the longest?
I think I had a transaction close once in about 25 days from signing the APA to closing. There are certain manufacturers that move a little more quickly than others. And this was a deal where, and these deals happen from time to time, where a manufacturer has a dealer that they really like already, and they've got a selling dealer who they want out because they don't like so much. And so, you know, often these things come to us where the manufacturer, the buyer, and the seller have all already been talking about the deal and have agreed, let's get this done as quickly as possible. And the manufacturer already knows the buyer, and so it makes it a lot easier to get the deal across the finish line more quickly. As far as the longest, gosh, I don't have an exact number of months, but it was more than six. And I would say that the problem there was, one, we were dealing with multiple manufacturers and a couple of manufacturers who are some that move a little more slowly and ask for more detailed information and want every single I dotted exactly right and T crossed exactly right. The buyer in that instance had kind of a complicated ownership structure. And so getting that sort of presented in a way that the manufacturers felt comfortable with and understood, and it was very clear and it fit on their forms exactly the way they wanted it to, just really took some time.
Paul, you mentioned at the beginning about obviously not all attorneys being kind of equal in terms of being the best fit for handling a specific dealership buy-sell transaction. So, Monica, what should a dealer look for when choosing a buy-sell attorney? And are there any red flags they should avoid? What's your best advice on this?
My best advice would be to ask around to their other dealer friends, to their broker, if they've got a broker representing them, about if they've got recommendations of people they worked with in the past and that they felt like did a good job. Certainly, if they don't already have their own counsel that, like Paul mentioned, at the very least is experienced in M&A work. But I think it is also important generally to have someone who knows the auto industry and is specifically accustomed to dealing with some of the nuances that go into the buy-sells for dealership buy-sells. So again, I think in my experience and the way a lot of clients get to us is just word of mouth. Ask around. Ask for recommendations and referrals from people who you trust, who have had their own experiences in this space.
Yeah, good advice. So in your experience, when we're looking at a buy-sell, one of the things that comes up frequently in an asset purchase agreement is indemnification. And I'm just curious on your thoughts. We see a lot of cap. We see a lot of basket, sometimes no cap, no basket. There's so much that goes into an indemnification. And as a broker, having been through well over 200 buy sells myself now, I think I've only had two issues in my whole career where it's anything has come from it. And I'm not saying we shouldn't protect our clients by any stretch, but at the same time, what's your advice when you get into these things? Because it really can be one that will go back and forth for, I've seen it go weeks back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the most heavily negotiated provisions of a buy-sell. And you're right. Rarely does it come into play. And so that's what I try to counsel my clients on is, one, it is important in case it does come into play. And it certainly can. And it does at times, but it is rare. A couple of things I tell, especially my seller clients about indemnification is, look, you know your business. You've been running this business for years. You know the kinds of issues that might come up and that have come up. And so that's what we're talking about here, really, are the same issues that were coming up or could have come up when you owned it. Just now you won't own it. And so for a period of time after you sell the dealership, the buyer is going to ask you to stay on the hook for these things and stand behind them. And so, again, you kind of know the risk here about whether or not you think these things are going to come up. And we do want to protect you as the seller by placing some limitations on what you're going to be responsible for. But we don't want to kill the deal over it. Generally, it's silly because it's not going to come up that often. And so let's try to get to a place that everybody can live with, both sides, and move on. You know, and from a buyer standpoint, again, it's an allocation of risk about who's going to have to be responsible for things after the fact. And a buyer, it just has to consider how much risk they're willing to take in the deal and how much they want to push it, knowing all the while that the chances of something coming up are relatively unlikely, and that if you want to get the deal done, you need to work to a solution, again, that everyone can live with, and probably no one's going to get 100% of what they want in this instance, but we can try to come to a compromise that, you know, is reasonable and works for everybody.
I love the way you stated you've been running this business. You know your business. We have one right now that, and the reason I brought it up, we have one right now. It's been going on for a month on one issue, indemnification, and it's gone back and forth. And I've kind of said, like you have, that we're representing the seller. And I've said, hey, look, we're only talking about from the day of closing backwards, nothing forward. I mean, once you've sold the business, you've sold the business. But unless there's something you're concerned about or don't know about, you would be responsible for this anyway if you kept the business. So thanks for answering that.
Well, yeah. And so that's another point I will often make sort of on the seller side of things when we're talking about limiting the seller's exposure, is that when the buyer's pushing for unlimited amount of indemnification, I will point out the fact that, look, once we sell here, we don't have the ability to keep making money with this thing. We've given that up. And so we're not going to risk everything for this. It needs to be limited because we've given up our ability to make money with it. And so, yes, we'll stand behind some of it, but we're not going to risk it all.
Great point. Great point.
Kind of on that note, small stuff in the negotiations and buyers and sellers and each party getting frustrated. And obviously the big stuff matters, right? I mean, the protection that you mentioned, but what's your advice in terms of how buyers and sellers can prevent maybe the small stuff getting in the way? Because we wouldn't obviously want that to end up shattering a deal.
Yeah. You know, the way we generally like to negotiate a deal is send out an initial draft of the agreement, let the other side do their review, maybe turn a red line with their comments once, maybe even do that one more time back the other way. And then look, let's make a list of all the issues here that have not been resolved, and let's get everybody on the phone, buyer, seller, both sides' counsels, and let's just go through them and talk through them and find a way to resolve them. And we've found that that's the easiest way to get through some of those smaller issues, because it's a little harder when you've got the parties on the phone talking to each other to keep taking kind of the hard line stance on some of those small things, because it is a little bit silly and they start to feel a little bit silly, I think. Whereas when you're just passing back and forth drafts through email and through counsel, we kind of call it sales managing, right? You've got your attorney out there being the salesman, and they get to say, well, I got to go back to my sales manager and see what I can do for you here. And so it's easier to take hard lines on some of that stuff.
I like it. Get on the phone.
We love when an attorney says, hey, let's just get all the, let's get the principals, attorneys, broker, let's get everybody on the phone and walk through this. It kind of finishes that part of it.
The other thing I would point out on the small stuff is, look, you're losing more money here paying your attorney to negotiate this thing than you would if you would just make a deal on this one point. You know, on the truly small stuff, for sure.
Great point.
So we know that regulations and laws have a tendency to change. And just curious, is there anything that you're seeing that could possibly blindside a dealer today that maybe wasn't a concern 5 to 10 years ago?
nothing comes to the top of my mind as far as being able to get a deal done. I think the things that we're seeing now that are going to affect deals the most as far as laws go, and certainly with these tariffs that are coming in and the way it's going to affect the business. And the bottom line is, I think that we're going to start seeing profits come down, which are going to obviously make purchase prices come down for a while. And so that's really the biggest thing I think that's going to affect deals are just the valuations and the operation of the business and the profits. We've kind of come through a period here with COVID where for 3 or so years, we had record profits. And now those are kind of starting to decline again and come back down to earth, which will certainly affect deals and the way they get done and how many of them get done and the way buyers and sellers behave. When those profits start coming down, it tends to be a little more difficult to get deals negotiated because the margins aren't quite as high. And there's a little less motivation on the buyer side, and it does make it a little more difficult.
So curious if this has happened to you. I should knock on some wood behind me here. It has not happened to me. But have you ever gotten past due diligence, hard deposit, let's call it a week from closing? Maybe you've got approval from the manufacturer. You've got everything ready to go. Have you ever had one implode at that point? I haven't, but maybe you've seen that.
Yeah, I don't know that I've had one get quite that far. Certainly, we've had them get past the due diligence phase where the earnest money's gone hard and the deal blows up. And I've had circumstances where the buyer has just walked away from their earnest money and decided, you know what, I just really don't want to do it that much. And I'm willing to walk away from this earnest money. And mostly that's been because of kind of general economic conditions have changed or things like that, where the business is not nearly as attractive and it makes more business sense to walk away from your earnest money than to sink the rest of the money in this business that is not quite the same as when you first started.
When you're representing a seller, do you look for a higher earnest amount? Is that something that drives that? I would imagine it would.
Certainly, you know, when we're representing a seller, we tell them we want enough earnest money that the buyer is at least really going to have to think hard about walking away from it. We want it to hurt. If they're going to have to, if they're going to lose it.
How do you look at it? I mean, we tend to just put a number out there, and if we're representing the seller, we start higher and let a buyer push back. But do you look at it as a percentage? How do you typically look at how much earnest money you want to start at?
Yeah, it's generally at least loosely based on a percentage. And usually we try to aim for 5% or so, which is probably a little on the high side, honestly. As a seller, obviously. Now as a buyer, we don't. As a buyer, a lot of times we will not offer up earnest money until asked, and then we'll negotiate for the lowest amount, but also what's reasonable. Of course, most clients will tell you they have no intention of defaulting or walking away or losing their earnest money, so it doesn't matter. But again, it is, I think, very important for a seller to have that as kind of a extra protection to keep the buyer honest and to keep the deal on track. Because again, if it's too low, then a buyer may say, you know what, I get that I'm going to lose this money and I don't love that, but also it's worth it and I just don't want to do the deal. So if you get enough where it's not as easy for them to make that decision, it's obviously better for your seller.
When buyer and seller finally do make it to closing day, what do you see as the most challenging part of that process to get it done that day?
The most challenging part is just to get all the inventories done and reconciled and the numbers all agreed on, really. And so the earlier the parties can start working on that, the better. And often it's difficult to get them totally reconciled because the dealership is open until late the day before closing sometimes. And then the numbers are moving the whole day and you can't quite get there. In states where dealerships can't be open on Sunday. We generally like to close on Mondays for that reason, because we have all of Sunday to try to get that done. But yeah, I mean, the hardest part about a closing is just getting those numbers finalized, agreed upon, reconciled. And it just, I think it takes more time than anyone ever anticipates. And so the sooner you can start doing that, the better.
Yeah. What's your best practice recommendation for how much time to give yourself in advance of that closing date? Because I've seen some that are closed by 10, 11 a.m. and then some you're like, oh, it spilled into the next day.
Yes, for sure. You know, I would say have at least someone start inputting your inventory information a week or more before closing, and at least get started so that when you're ready to really start looking at it and reconciling to what's there the day of closing, it's quicker and easier. I would say the sooner you can get your parts inventory guys in there and doing the inventory, the better. Probably at least 2 days before the actual closing would be ideal, to give them time to get it done and then for buyer and seller to look at it and agree on it. Vehicle inventory, you know, I would say best to start really working on it 2 to 3 days before the actual closing, and then just start fine tuning it up to closing until you get there.
One of the things we've done over the last number of years is we start to ask for a used car list 30 days out, get the seller to request them to a buyer to bid it out and just say, hey, I know the cars are going to change. Some are going to come in, some are going to go out, but they really want to understand, how is this buyer going to treat me on the day of closing? So it sounds like you agree with that policy.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. The sooner you can start looking at that stuff, the better. And yes, on used cars, I would say ideally at least a week before, start looking at them. That way, one, your seller can start figuring out what they're going to do with the vehicles that the buyer is not taking, and they're not scrambling at the end to figure out what to do with them.
One question regarding due diligence. We have probably seen it all as far as the list that will come from a buyer requiring due diligence items to review. Sometimes a CPA will produce a 3-4 page document, and we'll go back to the buyer and say, hey, look, we'll get as much of this as we can, but if you're not going to look at the data and this is just a list from your CPA, can you help clean it up a little bit? Do you have any advice for a buyer specifically, because they're the ones that typically request it, on what they should be asking for, and maybe not specifically, but how do you have them manage that process?
Yeah, I think that you're right, Paul, that you really need to drill in on what are you really going to look at and what really does matter to you. What do you need to know about this business that you're buying to make a decision about whether or not you're going to buy it? And then some of the due diligence materials also, I think, play into what information are you going to need to complete your manufacturer application.
True.
But yeah, I would say, look, maybe you start from some big, long cookie cutter, general M&A due diligence list, but then let's really go through it and look at what do we really need to know and what do we really need to see, and whittle it down to make it easier on us and our seller so that we can get this deal done efficiently.
So one final question. At the end of the day, we know that buyers and sellers pretty much want the same thing, a smooth closing and a successful transaction. What is either your best piece of advice to make that happen, or something that maybe you haven't touched on yet that you want to leave our listeners with?
I think my best piece of advice would be to go in focused and ready to move as quickly as you can, and encourage your legal counsel and anyone else that you need to help get the deal done to do the same, and be willing to be available when you need to be available to make decisions and to have discussions to try to iron out any issues that arise. Often we'll have clients or the buyer or the seller on the other side who want the deal done, want the deal done, want the deal done, but oh, by the way, I'm going to be out of the country for 2 weeks and I'm unavailable here and I'm unavailable there. And I think we've all heard the saying, time kills deals, and it's true. And the quicker you can get a deal papered and then to the finish line, the better for everyone. And so my biggest advice would be, when you are ready to move forward with the process, commit and commit to getting it done and being available and to get it done efficiently.
Love it. Wonderful advice. So with that, Monica, thank you so much. This has been really great, really insightful. It's clear that having the right legal strategy in place can definitely make the difference between a smooth closing or a deal that drags on or worse, falls apart. So thank you so much for breaking it all down for us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And Monica, we hope to see you soon on another transaction.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.